Mr. Ken Johnston, Reel 2. How did your career in the line of courses and instruction proceed from there then, Mr. Johnston?
Well, I was back with the unit, you see, after these various courses. In Iceland, I was the carrier officer. I had rather an alarming experience there, actually, because there was a huge exercise about to take place. Because you must remember that the troops' families back at home were under more fire than we were. They were being under air raids, and in fact I used to write home to hundreds of them. I had a company, carriers and so forth. We were to do this very large exercise to keep the brigade and the whole division in Iceland up to scratch. But the weather was so terrible it was cancelled, and I had gone over these mountains to see if carriers really could get over there, and I was also going down to the American battleship, the Arlington, because we were going to do a concert party there, and the weather deteriorated so much, and there's so much lodestone, the compass won't show accurately, and I was with this corporal called Percival, who was my driver. And we'd gone on foot to see if we could take the brigade carriers over those mountains, and it really deteriorated, and the blizzard came, and we went further down to try and follow water and got into a ravine, and generally we were away for something like 30 hours, in which the alarm had gone off, and instead of having the exercise, many of the units were out looking for us, including some of the Daily Telegraph and other war correspondents who were there to cover the exercise, which had been cancelled, and they started sending these messages home. It was a bit embarrassing. One officer said to me, an old friend of mine, and if he'd only found me, he said, if only I'd found you, even on the end of a precipice, he said, I've just pushed you over, because they all had a very rough night looking for me. But that was the one of the rigours of Iceland, where the weather could change desperately badly. Then, you see, coming back, I was involved with what we called then the carriers, the anti-tank platoon, and we had also motorcycles. So that was the company one commanded. And I was back with the unit when, once again, I was called to say, you have been posted as instructor to the School of Infantry. Stop. This is a sort of telegram one got. I was at home, West Garth, the Ridgeway, Kenton, Newcastle-upon-Tyne. You have been posted as instructor to the School of Infantry. Stop. To report the 18th of February at the latest. To return here by Tuesday night in order to hand over before departure, the 11th Durham. So off I was now at the School of Infantry, where I had been a student, and now I was an instructor. Well, of course, this was the time when I remember there was a Colonel Wignall, who was a territorial officer, who was giving tactical lectures by the use of the blackboard. And one saw people like General Ritchie, who was there after the experiences in Knightsbridge and in the desert, sitting amongst with other officers who had high rank in action, listening to lectures about the use of down, crawl, observe, fire, and the tactics which the army was then really rubbing into everyone, and that there were a lot of blackboard movements going on, because that's all we could do at that time. The carrier platoon that I'd had, and then became the company commander in charge of all the equipment of that kind, and then to be instructing in the carrier wing at the School of Infantry, had really made me have a great feeling towards these exercises, towards leadership generally.
What did you think of the courses that you were now involved in running the School of Infantry?
Well, they had reached a much higher standard, but of course they were still very much based on theory, and it was the basic theory, of course, which really blossomed out into tactics in the field generally.
So they were doing valuable work.
Much better, yes. It improved enormously at that time.
What was the next stage then in your career?
No, I was back with my unit again as a company commander, and the experiences with the unit, as I say, after they had returned from Dunkirk, there was the Devon and Cornwall coast, we were in Iceland, and then we were in the Black Mountains in South Wales, and eventually the unit went to Thetford in Norfolk. But I had long since left, because once again another telegram had arrived, and this time it was to go to the War Office to report to a Colonel Corbett. Well, I got there, and there was this man with very large whiskers who told me he wasn't going to shave them off until the Hitler had been defeated. He was really Lord Rowallan, and he was using the family name of Colonel Corbett, and he said, "I've been looking at your record and your experience as an instructor, and I want you to come to Scotland, where we're going to start special training, because the Adjutant General, Sir Ronald Adam, had said that he wanted to reclaim as the highest possible percentage of officers who had been rejected by the War Office selection boards, or people who thought they could be made given commissions, but they were perhaps a little young, and NCOs who were suitable for commissions. He wanted to develop a course where such people could be re-enthused, retrained, and brought up to a standard suitable for a commission. Now, the first thought was to go to Northern Ireland, I think to County Down, but eventually the area around Newtonmore and Canusie was chosen. And I went up there with Lord Rowallan and one or two other officers, and a whole group of NCOs whom we wheedled down until we had what we thought would be our staff. And we were ready for the first intake. Well, they arrived and were met by a group of people with berries, with ropes around their, instead of belts, with corduroy trousers, with a very assorted kind of dress and an eager look in their eyes, and they were put onto trucks at Newton Moor, and then they travelled along what we call the Burma Road, because it went right up to this shooting lodge in the valley in near Canusie, and here we let them get off the trucks, and they looked up at the hillsides and the woods, and I have never seen such lost souls as the first course who arrived in Glenfeshie, because this was the valley. This was the valley where Landseer painted the Monarch of the Glen, and the tumbling river Feshie running down through the hills, and the lovely landscape either side, and the shooting lodge at the very end of the valley, and this was our setting. So the first thing we did with them was to let them get into the Nissen huts for the first night, and then point to the hillsides and say, "Well, for the next few nights you're going to camp over there. That's where you're going to live." And they looked across there and said, "What, over there? Yes. You go and find the wood, you build your bivouacs, and you look after yourselves on the hillsides." And then Duncan Chittum came and joined us. Duncan Chittum was the one of the head gillies for Lord Lovat, and an immense figure. He was one of the greatest possible shots, and he started teaching how to fire with the just off the target, and very often the target was them, so they got to know what it was like to be under fire. So we taught basic field craft, how to live out in the open and how to take care of themselves, and then how to use the contours and the hillsides and work in pure field craft, and we did weapon training too. They were in companies, there were two companies. I had one company, and Guy Matthews had another company, and then the chief instructor was a man called Bill Williamson. Well, we took over from the mountain and snow warfare people who'd come from Iceland, who had the lodge, and we took over from them, and the course proceeded, really developing its own training as we went.
So you hadn't worked out any plans for the first course of what you were going to do until I actually arrived, was it?
That's right. It was really something which we improvised as we went along. In the first case, of course, there was their own weapon training and there was the basic field craft. But we knew we had 10 weeks. Now, in the 10 weeks, we were going to give them the first 5 weeks in training and the second 5 weeks in exercising them in to see how they'd got on in their training. And a whole series of long schemes in the Cairngorms. In between, they had 3 days when they went back to their unit or went back home. The first 5 weeks, really, it was a question of imparting to them every ounce of confidence, because what we felt was that they had basically somewhere in their makeup a lack of confidence. And of course this is one of the great salient features of the characters one comes across in training so often, that very often there is somewhere a thread of lack of confidence, and if that can be found and if that can be tackled and if the assertion can come from within, then really a great deal has been achieved. Now, we did one thing which was possibly regarded as slightly un-British, and that is that after we had been out on a few hours training, we would ask them to sit down and write a report on each other member of the platoon. And that was a private report which was given to their platoon commander. Because we had the three platoons with a commander of each, a lieutenant, and myself, I was a company commander. And these reports were handed in, and it was very interesting because the chap who thought he'd probably made a big noise and a big impression and was very popular was not in fact so in these private reports. And when we'd asked them who would be number two in their opinion, it was very often somebody who'd not been terribly assertive at all. The difference between a number one and a number two came out significantly, that many people were suited to be a good administrator but not particularly a number one leader. And therefore, as these reports came in, we formulated our own opinion of the character of each person who was in our command, and then we spoke privately to them perhaps every 2 weeks and spoke clearly and sort of man to man about their situation and the weaknesses they had.
How often did they write their self-reports, you know, the reports they wrote about their comrades?
Well, that would happen possibly in the 10 weeks. They'd probably do that about half a dozen times. And, of course, one saw and has seen so much in this sort of training that it is the conflict with one's own standards which is important. One said to them that it's your own standard you're battling against. You've got to not necessarily be better than A or B, but better than yourself in the various aspects of your character that have been revealed to you. You are really competing with an inner man, your own standards, and that's what you have to win over. Of course, this confidence, or lack of it, was gradually adjusted by the series of exercises we did. One of them was taking a chest of ammunition and literally getting it up a hill and down the other side. It was a very heavy chest of ammunition and the person was alone with it. And sometimes tempers were lost, frustration set in, even tears were experienced, in rage and desperation and almost defeat. But getting that ammunition up there to the top of the hill in a lone effort with a great big heavy metal box of ammunition, that was a test. We had passed the ammunition.
How would they go about that sort of test?
Well, I mean, you just had to get on with it. I mean, some people looked at it, the stresses, and how they could lever it and how they could work it up the side. Some people just tried brute strength. Some people kicked it. They were. They had to get it up. And
did they usually manage it?
Yes, everybody had to manage it. They were left with it. There was no question of not getting it up. And then pass the ammunition was an exercise in which they were working in a group with boxes of ammunition, and they had to get along rivulets, and they had to get through barriers, and many of them which were man-made by us to create terrible conditions of mud and filth and so forth. That was called pass the ammunition. That was a team effort. That was the lone effort of the hillside applied as a team effort. Because we found they were the individuals and they were the team people. And so what we used to do sometimes is suddenly dispose of someone and say, you've been knocked out. And turn to, that would be the leader of six or seven men, and turn to the next one and say, now you are in command. Because this brought in the aspect of being a leader when you're tired. To be fresh is one thing, to be tired is another. The man who can lead in the morning is not always the man who can lead at night when it's been a long day and he's tired, when decisions have got to be made, where there is a great deal of exhaustion to be experienced. So we did that. We suddenly made people leaders. Our basis was that if you were going to fall 6 or 10 feet off the sides of a rock, we weren't going to stop you at all. But if it was going to be a 60-foot fall, well, we would really try and stop you. We did abseiling. We did rock climbing. We did these sort of exercises, getting, making a raft from gates, and getting across locks or rivers. All those outdoor items of initiative. And of course the various tests which developed in the War Office Selection Boards later on initiative and self judgment on how to cross places and how to use size of planks that are lying about, these sort of initiative tests, we were well into that sort of thing.
You said when they first arrived, they had one night in the Nissen huts and then were sent out into the hills.
Yes.
Bivouac for themselves.
Yes.
Did they stay out in their own bivouacs, or did they come back into the Nissen huts after they'd done that for a week or so?
Well, they stayed out there for two or three nights out in the bivouacs, and then they came back to the Nissen huts. But then the second 5 weeks, of course, we were on very long extended exercises. That part of Scotland was prohibited. You had to have an identity to move about. From Achnasheen onwards, for instance, I mean, there was always the threat of German paratroops. And we had exercises. One was the exercise Sky's the Limit, as I called it, in which they moved from one coast to the other and ended on Skye. Well, that had all sorts of things that happened. I mean, the Broadford Ferry, which was captured in the middle of all this exercise, was taken out to the other side of Skye. I mean, islanders were actually fainting seeing this ferry moving around out to sea, which had never been done before. And we had, we raided a telephone exchange, and the old lady in charge of the telephone exchange was taken over, and all the lines were crisscrossed. Police cars were stolen, because if they were left without the distributor caps off, they were fair game. You see, we had German uniforms, and we had about 12 of them in German uniforms, and the rest were flat out after them. The idea was they were trying to get away from the other side of Skye in a submarine, in a U-boat. So they were full-length exercises. I mean, people who were caught were put in the jail. We had the community were assisting us. And this was the real stuff, as far as you could, without live ammunition. And, of course, we didn't have the Air Force out spotting them, because that would have really been too much for them.
What was your role in an exercise like that?
Well, in an exercise like that, I mean, was what we used to call the umpires. I mean, I'd help to plan the whole exercise. And one would be, for instance, in Skye, I remember, walking all the night, checking on posts. Tremendous fitness one felt in those days. The sound of your army boots ringing out on the road and the moonlight and the hills round you, the coolins in the background, a tremendous sense of fitness. And one would be checking on positions. I remember once I hid in a cellar. It happened to be a wine cellar, and I couldn't get out because the people I was sort of watching were in the hotel. And when I did come out of the wine cellar, I'm afraid I was very, very unsteady on my feet. But you see, we had this feeling of fitness, confidence. You get a spirit that was noticeable amongst these cadets, as we call them, because when they left there, I mean, they could have taken Hitler on themselves. The feeling, the spirit was tremendous. And I remember, of course, the concert parties, which I'd always been mixed up with concert parties. I mean, I had them in Iceland to go around the coast to all sorts of outposts with a Durham Light Infantry concert party. And here I was at the Highland Fieldcraft down in Canusie. We had shows like I Can Hardly Wait and It's Terrific. All the nurses came down from Port Alabaster, which was this great big bay over at Pulieu, and all the ACAC posts and so forth, they used to come down to these shows. See, I ought to explain that we worked in two places. We worked in the Cairngorms, and this was in the summer. We worked all around those mountains in the Cairngorms. And then in the winter, we moved over to Pulieu in Westeros. And there, because the snowfall in the Cairngorms would have made it difficult for us getting about, and the snow didn't lie so heavily on the west coast because of the salt in the air, etc. So we were based at Pulieu. And that was another situation, a different sort of range, the Torridon Range, which very hard, flint-like substance, and not so many trees, much more windswept, and some of the courses were partly at one and partly at the other, or some of the courses were entirely in the Cairngorms or entirely in Westeros, according to the time of the year they were there. I must say that by the time I was there in Westeros, of course my zeal and drive to get these exercises tougher and tougher was very apparent. And of course it leads one to think that there should be perhaps a limit to the amount of time that a person spends on running such courses. You get what we used to call in the army bloody minded, you know, you get tougher and tougher. We were working under worse conditions around Westeros. We didn't have that lovely shooting lodge as the headquarters. I was in a house where Lord Rowallan was too, which was about 4 or 5 miles from Pulieu. And it was just near that beautiful garden at Inverurie, the marvellous gardens, the tropical gardens which are on that coast. And we had a concert party there. As I say, we brought all the nurses and ACAC units and naval people, because there was this huge bay nearby where the ships came to collect before they were taking in convoy across the Atlantic.
This bloody-mindedness you mentioned, how did that manifest itself? What, could you explain exactly what you mean?
Well, what I mean about that is that if you are pushing people and trying to make the conditions as realistic as possible, one is inclined sometimes to make each course rather tougher than the last one. If you find that the weather is reasonably kind, it allows one to achieve more, and you may continue to do that, but find that the weather in the next course or the next time is not so kind. On the edge of Loch Maree there is Ben Sleac, and that is a great finger that sticks out above the clouds above Loch Maree, and I remember taking about 200 of them up there, and at the top there was a great deal of frost about. It was icy, And one or two of them started glissading on their heels, you know, crouching on their heels and going down partly on their backsides and partly on their heels. And when I saw that, I said, don't do that. Now, I'm giving you this as an instance of the problems of being an instructor under these conditions. Visibility very bad. We were about 3,250 feet up, whatever. Everybody not clearly to be seen. The instructions went out not to glissade, but one chap had done that, and he went over the top of an outcrop, and when I got to him, he was bleeding from the ears and the nose, and I realised that it could be a fractured skull. So I ordered them to carry him with his... so that his head, neck was firmly held and didn't wobble about, and as soon as possible we got something to carry him on. I think we found some piece of wood, or we strapped him, and we carried him further down, and we got to a gate which we were able to use, and I sent on ahead for the ambulance to be there from the Gerloch Hotel, which is now a lovely hotel up at Gerloch, but was then a large hospital for the naval. So we got him down there, and he had damaged vertebrae in his neck. And then there was this worrying time about what would happen. And I remember the Padre Birbeck there, who went on to the commandos later. And I met him not long ago, well, perhaps 3 years ago. I think he's in Aberdeen. Padre, and I remember him, and I was very disconsolate, and I said to him, let's pray for this guy, that he does live, because it's upsetting when that sort of thing happens. But he did, and later he became a dentist in Edinburgh, I think. His name was Gibson, and he recovered. And that, I remember the Padre reminding me of this only 2 or 3 years ago when we met, because there were casualties. I didn't have any in my in my particular company, but one boy, not far from the Sligachan Inn on Skye, where we were to rally after an exercise over the Coolins, which were very, very rough and dangerous mountains, he collapsed, overcome by the cold. Complete exposure, his heart stopped, and when we found him, he was only about 200 yards from the Sligachan Inn. These things happened.
He died then?
He died, and altogether, I think we lost about three. Because, naturally, when you are dealing with people and pressing them, and they're going under all sorts of rigorous treatment, this can happen.